But was it from down here? Or?
I'm going to just put you in.
Shoot.
I forget. Yes.
Hey.
Next week, play worse.
Oh, okay.
You had a paper. Can I
have some paper?
Okay, the Environment, Economic Development, and Agriculture Division for Monday, March 4th, 2013 will come to order. Thank you for waiting a week or whatever it was you waited. Appreciate it. We have the Board of Water and Soil Resources in today, Bowser. Let's go through your budget there and is this what you're going to be working off of? Or no, this one here you'll be working off of.
Mr. Chairman, we'll operate off of both of those. We'll do our best to move through quickly. I know you've got an agenda that has some visitors from a long way away here too. You want to make sure you get to them. So,
you do have snow coming in, but it's not here already. But anyway, go ahead and give us an update.
You know, Mr. Chairman, members, John Jasky, Director, Board of Water and Soil Resources, and with me is Sarah Stroman, our Assistant Director. And so we will tag team this and walk through the presentation that is the slideshow that you have in front of you. We also have this, as you held up, Mr. Chairman, this summary that has included in it on the back page of the spreadsheet that really shows the specifics of the line items that are in the budget. So if you want to get to that level of detail, we can go there as well. With that, I will start with the PowerPoint presentation that you have in your packet as well as on the screen. And we're here to present our fiscal year 14 and 15 biannual budget. Oops. Got two computers here, Mr. Chairman. There we go.
Are they both working?
They're both working. Only one's on the screen, though. That's a good thing. Mr. Chairman,
do you want to put one down that's not that you don't need, or do you need both of them?
As long as I know which finger to push on which button, that's all I need to do.
I know, but is one distracting you, or
no,
are you using both?
No, we're going to use one computer, and Mr. Chairman, the members that are the folks behind us are going to use this other machine, and we'll just leave that one sit there so I don't do something to it I don't want to do. We're going to give you a quick overview on all of the various funds that our agency uses to carry out our programs. We'll focus on the general fund specifically. Sarah will give you a little bit of detail about the Clean Water Fund, the Outdoor Heritage Fund. These are, of course, the two legacy amendment funds that we have a portion of in our budget, and also the Environment and Natural Resources Trust Fund, which is a separate category as well. Our agency mission is to work with and through local governments and through local organizations to carry out our conservation and clean water work. We focus our work on private lands. Obviously, the DNR and others are the major landholders on the public land side, and we focus on the private lands, and that's therefore working with local governments who have the land use authority, have that local network of staffing and officials to carry out the programs is really critical to the way we do our work. We have a small agency. We have about 80 or so full-time equivalents, but we multiply that by using that local conservation delivery system that's carried out through a variety of local governments, cities, counties, soil and water conservation districts, watershed districts, and even in some cases townships. Of course, many of them work with other local partners, nonprofit organizations, and local associations that may also take part in doing some of that conservation and clean water work. We have a board. Our board has a membership of 20. It includes county commissioners, so water district officials, watershed district managers, township officials, cities, and we also have the agencies of natural resources, agriculture, pollution control, and health on our board, as well as the University of Minnesota, and then three citizens. So we have a board of 20 that does the policymaking and makes the decisions ultimately on the funding in terms of grants and other program dollars that get routed to local governments.
And so do you communicate with your partners other than on the board?
Mr. Chairman, yes, we do that regularly. We're doing that daily and sometimes hourly, it seems, especially this time of year. Here's the membership of the board. They're distributed around the state. As I mentioned before, we have about 81 staff in various regional locations that we have office space. Many of those, I think all of them, are co-located with another agency, either state or federal. And you can see here at the bottom of this slide, it shows the various local governments that we use to carry out those conservation and clean water programs. I mentioned before, the local implementation aspect of our agency relies on those local agents, and they use their...
Why don't you go back to that slide before?
Sure.
And just give us a real quick what these soil and water conservation watershed districts, just real quick what they do.
Okay. Sure. That's a good point, Mr. Chairman. The soil and water conservation districts, we have a soil and water conservation district in each county, a couple of counties, the larger ones, St. Louis being one of them, Polk, as well as Otter Tail. Large counties have a split, so they have, in the case of St. Louis, a north and a south. The other two, they have an east and a west. But we have a soil and water conservation district in every county. They operate as local officials that are elected, and they do not have an independent taxing authority. They rely on the counties to do that base funding, as well as the state budget. You'll see that in our proposal here. And also have a reliance on the federal government, particularly the U.S. Department of Agriculture, to help with providing a funding for their operations. They also pursue other grants and project dollars through other means. Watershed districts, I don't think we have a map in our presentation, but we can certainly get you that. They are special governments established through petition. There are about 46 of them, and they are concentrated in the metro area and the Red River Valley area, but we also have some in southern and central Minnesota and a couple down in the southeast, and also one in the central part of the state, the Sauk River watershed, and a few others. So there are they do not have a coverage over the entire state, but they're formed via petition, and they can be formed anywhere in the state through that process. Mm-hmm. Of course, we all know about county governments having responsibility for land use decisions. A lot of them tie to water. They address the wetland conservation issues, the septic issues. Some of them do feedlot programs. They carry out a lot of those local land use decisions through their ordinances. And then the metropolitan area, the seven-county metropolitan area, we have organizations, we call them WMOs, or watershed management organizations. They were formed based on statute that was passed in Minnesota back in 1982. In the seven-county metro area, we have a mandate to do a watershed management program. Largely started out with a volume or flooding issue as the primary impetus for it, but more recently it's focused a lot more on water quality as well. Many of those communities, cities that are part of these WMOs or watershed districts have specific programs to deal with water quality today. So it's a quick overview, Mr. Chairman. We have more we can certainly prepare you with or give to other members of the committee that want to know more. Again, those local authorities have that land use connection, mostly through ordinances, often through rules that they have at the local level in the case of watershed districts. They have, each of them, a water management plan that they are responsible for that the state ultimately reviews and approves, and that plan is what underpins their operations. It also is the basis for the state providing the grant funding to each of those local organizations to carry out the work that's in those plans.
Excuse me, just for the record, the quorum is present. Okay, go ahead.
We'll continue. Last year, there was a piece of policy passed that emphasized the greater emphasis on the watershed as the way to do our water management and water planning. Now, that was a very substantial change because you can imagine that counties and soil and water conservation districts who for many years, decades, centuries have been working on their county boundaries now are going to be given the opportunity to work across those boundaries on a watershed basis. And that is something that will be showing up later in the budget as one of the initiatives that the governor has proposed for some additional startup funding. We also use those local plans and the data sets that they have developed or derived from state sources, and the state has provided a great deal of the information that these local governments use. A lot of that has come, not only recently since the amendment, but began back in the late 80s when these original requirements or opportunities to do these local water plans were first developed. One of the key things that they do is find the most critical places on the land to do the right kind of project and then work with that private landowner to get the project accomplished, or groups of landowners is often the case. Our agency has been in existence for 25 years. It was formed back in the late 1980s, a merger of three different agencies. And you can see just a real summary of the different kinds of things that have been accomplished during that 25-year period.
Can you tell us all 15,000?
I don't think I can. I don't think you probably would want me to either, Mr. Chairman. But where I can tell you this information does exist is in each of those local governments. They keep track of each project that they do, each practice, and they are responsible for both finding it, building it, and then maintaining it for the duration of its useful life. The next item on this list is conservation easements, and we carry out this responsibility through our Reinvest in Minnesota program through a combination of bonding funds, federal funds, and more recently through the conservation easements to the legacy amendment. That Reinvest in Minnesota program is very successful. We've been able to accomplish many wetland restorations and grassland restorations, mostly in the agricultural area of the state. We can show you more about that program in future days. We, as I mentioned, have the responsibility to review and approve those local water plans that counties, soil and water conservation districts, watershed districts, and in some cases cities are part of. Those plans typically have a lifespan of about 10 years. Many of them do get amended during that time period because something has changed, and those plans lay out the projects, programs, funding sources, and responsibilities that those local agencies are going to carry out for that 10-year period. We also have a responsibility to administer the Wetland Conservation Act, which is the state's wetland protection program. And we do that in partnership with some federal agencies, too, because they have a role in making sure that our programs and their programs work together well. One of the most successful examples of that is our wetland banking program, where we use a system to restore wetlands that have been lost otherwise and use those to offset impacts that are going to occur now and into the future so that we have an efficient and effective way to do wetland mitigation or replacement.
Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Jasky, I'm looking at the 243,000 acres of wetlands and grasslands restored and then the 10,000 acres of credits. Now, are those acres then used to count against any changes there might be in agriculture? Or because, you know, we keep hearing that there's all these wetlands that are being lost, but here I'm looking at a pretty significant amount of acres that are being restored, and how does that balance out?
Mr. Jasky.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Scoey, I can't give you the balance sheet here with these numbers, but I can tell you that these 243,000 acres of restored wetland and grassland are, you know, above and beyond any requirement to do any mitigation or offset any impacts. And so, and yes, those are acres that have largely been accomplished in the agricultural area of Minnesota. So those would be a net gain, so to speak, of those acres. Now, obviously, the math on, you know, losses and other ways to measure that is something we'd have to do in a much more lengthy discussion. But the federal government policies, of course, have changed over time as well. And this reflects 25 years of work in that area. So these are all net gain acres.
And why don't you just give us a little idea how the wetland bank works?
Okay. Mr. Chairman, yeah. And members, the way it works is we have a state law called the Wetland Conservation Act, and that law says that if a wetland is drained or filled, there's an opportunity to offset that by mitigating it or replacing it somewhere else. And the way the wetland bank works is that we have individuals or organizations that have created a wetland somewhere with the sole purpose of making it available for sale in small increments to someone who's going to drain or fill a wetland elsewhere and doesn't have a way to come up with their own offset. So the one real straightforward example I can give you is that for road authorities, you can imagine that they have, they're building a new road, they're typically either widening it or adding turn lanes or something of the sort for safety reasons, and they will, you can imagine in some places, nick wetlands here and there as they widen or upgrade that road. And rather than trying to do something on site to offset that by making another piece of wetland somewhere nearby, they can either buy credits from someone who's built one somewhere else, or they can actually make credits of their own by creating a wetland somewhere else in advance. And then it's simply an accounting system to make sure that we're meeting no net loss. And that's been in place in Minnesota since the mid-1990s, and it's the wetland banking system here in Minnesota is by far the most comprehensive one in the country, and the federal government has used it as a model for when they developed rules back in 2008 for how that wetland banking program ought to work. So it's been well received. It's in the case of the road authorities, it does take some public funding to make sure that all works well, but that's been done through the bonding program in the last decade and a half or so.
Senator Scoy.
Thank you. Well, Mr. Jasky, is the state achieving its no net loss goal?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Scoy, by and large, yes. You know, we track the reports that local governments give us each year of the wetland losses and then the offsets that occur with those. The one thing that's a little bit challenging is that there are a number of activities that are exempt, which don't require reporting, so we really don't know for sure on some of those. So in terms of the way we would define that standard of the law, yes. In terms of the way we would describe it on the ground is a, I guess I would give you an I don't know at this point, but we do have a process underway in cooperation with the other agencies. DNR is leading it to do this assessment so that we actually can measure on the ground whether we're meeting that standard on a scale that's for sure statewide and probably being able to be scaled down to a county level to determine whether or not we're meeting it there as well. We'd be happy to come in and present that information to you and others at some point in the future. Mr. Chairman, members, I'll continue on with our goals. These are fairly obvious, I suppose, but protecting and restoring our water resources are critical. Soil is also a part of that. We know that the way soil is managed on the landscape greatly affects the way the water resources are going to be evaluated. Soil movement is a key indicator of water quality issues, and so holding the soil in place is one of the things that we've been spending more time than we have in the recent past trying to work with local governments and landowners on. Second point here is that we've, in order to be able to be successful in delivering our programs and statutory mission, we have to make sure that our local agents are ready and able to carry them out as prescribed. And so we've been adding some additional effort to make sure that through training programs and other means, we're making sure they're as ready to go as they need to be. Goal number three is about evaluating the effectiveness or the success or lack thereof, and we have a systematic approach to do that. There's actually a statutory responsibility that was created in 2007 to do that, and we can give you more information about that program at some point if you're interested. Agency goal number four is in this stage, we have a public drainage system that is a piece of infrastructure that has been put in the hands of the trustees at the county or watershed level to manage those drain systems. Through statute and other means, we've coordinated the work to prepare consensus recommendations and policy shifts to make sure that that drainage system is being operated as efficiently as it can, and now bringing into account some variables that weren't envisioned, 138 years ago when that law was passed, which include, storing and treating some of that water that also needs to be removed from the landscape to make the land productive. The last item here is to make sure that everything that we do in our local governments is able to be understood by others, both in terms of transparency of the funding and the authorities, but also making sure that we communicate well the investments that the state's making in those projects and practices. So to the budget numbers, the couple of slides here just to show the pieces of it. Slide that shows the graph on the left. You can see there the Clean Water Fund has actually become the largest component of the agency budget, and that's important because those dollars all represent projects and practices that are accomplished through local government programs. And so that is an additional amount of money that is going directly to the land to be able to restore and protect our water resources. And we have a whole variety of different kinds of projects and practices, as you can imagine, but we can cover those in some detail later, and Ms. Stroman will do that in her part of the presentation. The general fund's about 25%, and that's what we'll focus on here today. And there are other state funds as well, and some federal funding that comes from a variety of sources that's a little less predictable than the other funds. If you look at the slide on the right, you can see that, of all of our budget funds that are assembled together.
What are the other state funds?
Oh, the other state funds. These are largely interagency transfers. There are a couple of examples of where the Pollution Control Agency and the DNR have sent money to us to have as grants that go in a consolidated fashion to local governments. PCA has responsibility for the feedlot program and the septic program. They simply transfer money to us, so we combine it with ours and give them one state grant to minimize the administration of that. So that's where those things show up. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's also funding from LCCMR, which are several one-time projects that are combined in this biennial budget year. The chart on your right shows the total portion of how our funding is used, and you can see that in this case, 88%. This is about average, for quite a long time now, that 88% or so has been is directed through program and project grants to local governments, and the other portion is for our agency operations and oversight. So the general fund breakdown on this chart, we have these four categories. Obviously, each of them has got subcategories beneath that, and at some point we can walk you through those details, too, if you'd like to see that. But the first category is about the required programs that local governments, starting with counties, specifically are required to carry out, and we, the state provides a portion of the funding for that, the wetland protection programs. Again, I talked about those pass-through dollars for septics and feedlots and shoreline protection, and our local water management programs all get funded out of that component. I guess I mentioned local water management already. That's a grant that goes to counties. In some cases, they pass that money on to soil and water conservation districts or share it with them in terms of carrying out their local water planning programs. We have a component here for the agency operations and administration. And then we also have a portion here for local project dollars that goes to soil and water conservation districts for their project work. The couple of highlights, you can see that I mentioned already there are three subcomponents of this first category. Natural resources block grants, which go to counties, and all of these funds are matched at the local level, too. And generally that isn't a big issue, but in some cases local governments are already, as you know, strapped for funding, and they have now an obligation to bring some of their local funds to get the state funding. Some of that is in kind. Some of it is actual cash match. The drainage law piece of this is not something that we require a local match for because we don't send that money out in grants. That's the one program that stays with the agency by and large, and we work with a group of stakeholders to develop programs and policies from that. The just this past year, Mr. Chairman, you had asked about wetlands, and so we, under the direction of the governor, carried out his executive order, which came out of last session, looking at some different policy recommendations to improve and strengthen that wetland protection law. At this point, there are no budgetary consequences to this. We will be considering potentially some policy recommendations that will come out of this in the next week or so. We'll have a chance to talk with that in the policy committee, I would think, first, perhaps at this committee at some point thereafter. You can see that over the last few biennium, given the state of the budget, we've had reductions, and you can see that these reductions have taken place in all of our programs. In particular, the block grants that go to local governments have been decreased by, you can see, somewhere in the neighborhood of, 10 to 20%. That's probably true across all of the categories of funding that we have. Few more details about the local water management program. There are grants that go to soil and water conservation district for them to deliver their responsibilities. As I mentioned, they get a portion of their base funding from the state, a portion from their county, and a portion from the federal government, although I would say all three of those categories have been under pressure and being reduced, and so they do not have separate levy authorities. They rely on the state as a component of their base funding. We also have three special regional organizations that were identified in statute: the Red River Basin Commission, which operates across Minnesota, Manitoba, North Dakota, and South Dakota a little bit, to deal with flooding and other issues in Red River Basin. We have a Minnesota River Joint Powers Board, again, commission in statute to operate as a joint powers of counties across the Minnesota River Basin. And we also have called Area 2. It's a part of the Minnesota River that's south and west of the main stem. They have a great deal of flooding in that area, and they have formed a joint powers authority to manage some of the flooding. So we have small pieces of our budget that go to these organizations for some of their base operations. And then we have an initiative, as I mentioned earlier, the One Watershed, One Plan, that is in the governor's budget, $450,000 per year. This would provide some grant funding and some staff support to move towards over the next, I'm going to say, somewhere between 3 to 10 years it's going to take to go from having all of the counties now having a water plan on their county boundary to working on watershed plans that can build on and enhance the work that's being done at the state on the water quality issues and as well as flooding and turn those into watershed-based plans. Now, that's going to take some work and commitment on their behalf, but they pursued the policy changes last year that were completed, and so we believe that, as we move forward, we'll be able to pursue this approach, which we think is going to be, for the long haul, the way to go.
So this is new, right?
This is new, Mr. Chairman, yes.
Is the money for staff? Was it for grants? What's it for exactly?
Mr. Chairman and members, this is about half of that would be for staff, and the other half would be for grants. I think in the governor's budget we had two FTE, and the remainder for grants to local governments to give them some incentive to move towards this one watershed approach. Again, you can see the history of the funding here, and of course, the biggest category is the grants that go to the Soil and Water Conservation District, from the Conservation Delivery Program, and you can see those have, you know, obviously gone down. We tried to protect those base grants for counties and Soil and Water Conservation Districts over the last couple of biennium, and we had the major budget problems, and so things that took a hit were some of the project dollars specifically. The base grants did go down, in this case, about maybe 10%. We also have an initiative under the agency operations, a small one. It's $125,000 per year on internal controls. As you know and other members, the expectations and the process of how we go about documenting not only our expenditures but also those of our local governments has, you know, greatly increased. The transparency expectations have risen, and so this is a small amount of money for us to build the systems to be able to do that with the expectations that have increased over the last several years. Again, you can see that these numbers have changed.
Is that previous one, is that one person then? Is that what that is?
Mr. Chairman, yes, that'd be one person, an internal control specialist that would be added to our budget through the governor's recommendations.
Is that an accountant? Is that what that is?
Mr. Chairman, it would be someone with those skill sets, but probably more than that, because they also have to go out and work with local governments. But I would say that would be one of the likely skill sets that we'd be looking at. Yes, a fiscal person would be certainly a part of it. I mentioned some of the project dollars, and these dollars have shrunk dramatically over the last several bienniums, but we do have base grant that goes to Soil and Water Conservation Districts for project work. They bring these dollars to private landowners, and they use some of the private landowner money to help with getting those projects built. Now, they aren't all as dramatic as this picture would show here, but I just wanted to mention, because if you're looking at our budget documents, you may see some funding for this area that was appropriated last biennium, and it was a special appropriation to deal with the problems we see in the North Shore and other parts of the state with regard to flooding that occurred last summer. The goal is to use these funds to prevent damage from happening in the first place, the base funds, but of course we see sometimes we see events that go well beyond the predictable results that would otherwise, you know, be able to be designed, and we see problems like this that have to be fixed after the fact. And so there's many of these projects that are being now repaired or restabilized following that flood event last summer. And at some point, we can give you a lot more information about what the results have been of that flood response sometime, you know, later on if you're interested in that. And you can see here these dollars.
Are we getting the money out?
Mr. Chairman, yes, we are. We just, in the last week and a half, sent $1.9 million up to the South St. Louis SWCD. We're looking to send a similar amount in the next week or two up to the Duluth, and we've also sent some money to the Goodhue and Dakota, Pine County, Aiken County. Basically, all those counties that were in that disaster area have gotten, you know, their initial allocations that they had asked for. Obviously, there's not enough money to pay for everything that they need. In fact, we think we've got about half of it. Now, we're also pursuing federal funding because that's what the statute says is second priority for finding funds, first priority being insurance money, and third priority being the state dollars. So we're going methodically about that. But, yes, the dollars are out there.
And do you have anything to do with the money that goes to the individual homeowners?
Mr. Chairman and members, some of that is exactly for that sort of thing. Our money is for a couple of different things. The main thing is it's for stabilizing these banks that are causing some threat to either infrastructure or natural resources. They're also funding through the other departments. The Department of Natural Resources has money to do home buyouts. FEMA dollars, you know, through HSCM are for the public infrastructure, and so our funding is for the private infrastructure where there's a threat or a risk that has to be dealt with. And we've got a Minnesota Recovers Task Force that's responsible for determining which money goes to which projects and which priority. But largely we rely on those local agents, the local governments that are, you know, right there working with these problems to give us their prioritized list, and we work from that.
And so have the individual homeowners been applying for the money? Or,
Mr. Chairman, yes, they have. We've got, as I said, we've got Right now, $22 million worth of projects on the list, and there's $11 million available. So we're working through that list. First, it's emergency, then it's urgent, then we keep going down the list in priority order to try and fund the projects that are most needed.
Okay. Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Jasky, with regards to flood, when you do buyouts of property up along the Red River, do you get involved in that too? With these projects, or is that pretty much all FEMA money?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ingebrigtsen, the actual home buyouts are handled through the Department of Natural Resources. They use their flood damage reduction funds to do two things. One is to buy out properties so they can let the flood come through safely and not harm infrastructure. And secondly, they build infrastructure where needed to hold and store and protect infrastructure that's got people or other property value away from the flood. So those are Department of Natural Resource responsibilities. Our funding in the Red River is really about restoring wetlands and holding water on the land upstream. In the case of the last summer's event, where it was, a much different kind of flood, you're talking about much more highly sloped areas and not a spring melt flood, but a summer rainfall flood. We had a lot of stream damages. There was, homes and other infrastructure that was adjacent to these streams where we saw either damage or damage that could yet happen because of instability. And the agencies have all got a plan of response there. And the federal funding, the FEMA funding, is handled through the Department of Public Safety, Homeland Security Management. They're the ones that bring that state match to those public projects that have public responsibility. The private landowners are the ones that we work with.
So Mr. Chair, thank you. Just a quick follow-up. So I visited with somebody from St. Vincent, Minnesota, believe it or not, the other day, which is way, way up in the northwest corner, and an old-timer, and he said he had sold his house out so they could build a dike. Would that be the DNR that would do that?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ingebrigtsen, it would likely be the local government operating with some funding that they would have received from the Department of Natural Resources and possibly some federal sources as well.
Okay. Thanks.
Mr. Chairman, so I'll continue. You can see that the cost share funding, the project dollars here, have actually been reduced by about 50% over the last few bienniums. So, again, the budget challenges of the past bienniums have been noted in this category in particular. So with that, I'm going to stop because that's the end of our general fund presentation and turn it over to Ms. Stroman to go through the Clean Water Fund and the other sources.
Any questions of Mr. Jasky before he turns it over? Okay, Ms. Stroman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Again, my name is Sarah Stroman. I'm an assistant director with the Board of Water and Soil Resources. And my goal here is to walk through the Clean Water Fund portion of our budget primarily. I'll also just mention briefly proposals that we have that are recommended from the Lasard Sands Outdoor Heritage Council and the Legislative Citizen Commission on Minnesota Resources, just so we round out the whole budget picture for you. Again, here, the pie chart you see on the left is the same pie chart we started the presentation with. Again, it just shows the portion of our total budget that comes from the Clean Water Fund. It is an important part of the Bowser budget. And I just do want to note that, of course, the Clean Water Fund program implementation is a multi-agency effort, and so it's important to put our programs in context with what the other agency is doing. But mostly what you'll see, and I'm going to walk through the three program categories that are there in the pie chart on the right, our focus is really on the non-point source pollution prevention programs. So our clean water funding breaks down, as you see on the pie chart, on the right side, the largest amount, the $50.4 million, is for clean water projects and practices. These all go out to our local government partners through competitive grants. The next category is the permanent conservation easements, so the $15.6 million budget amount. And then finally, results measurement and evaluation. And this is our agency's oversight of these dollars that are going out and the reporting of the outcomes. Just to note where our projects have been located and where the funding has gone over the last couple biennia, we do have a statewide reach in our clean water programs. And I'll briefly walk through each of these four competitive grant programs that are funded through the Clean Water Fund. Again, all of these grants are two local units of government that are working under a current state-approved and locally adopted water management plan or under an approved TMDL.
Could just what did those big white spots mean on those on the chart before on the map?
Those white spots are counties that have not received funding under that biennium of funding.
I was afraid of that. Okay. Go ahead.
All right.
Senator Saxon.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think that's because they have too much clean water.
That's it. Maybe the water's already clean there. That's probably good. Okay.
Mr. Chairman, I'll continue. One other thing I'd like to note on all of these grants is that they do require a minimum match of 25%, so we're leveraging a minimum of 25% of the total project cost from non-state funding sources on all of these. The first category of projects, the surface and drinking water protection and restoration projects, these are funds that are used for structural or vegetative practices to improve water quality along lakes, rivers, streams. They're also used for SSTS abatement grants for low-income people and for feedlot management water quality improvements.
SSTS?
Septic systems, Mr. Chairman. The next category, the targeted local resource protection and enhancement grants, these are grants to local governments to do mostly non-project work. These might be tools that help local governments target where practices will have the best effect for water quality or ordinance work in order to help these governments achieve outcomes that are above what the state requires. The conservation, drainage, management, and assistance are grants that fund the installation of water quality improvement practices on drainage systems. And finally, the Community Partners Clean Water Program is a grant program. It's kind of like a small grant program. These grants go to local units of government who then re-grant to other community partners, lake associations, sportsmen's clubs, other non-governmental organizations that might want to participate in water quality improvement projects. I also just want to note on all of these grants, we try to track the outcomes, and the local units of government are required to track what they're doing with the money and what the outcomes are that they're achieving. And so one of the things that we track are the phosphorus and nitrogen reductions that are achieved through these projects. So this is just an example over the last couple of years on those that first category, the surface and drinking water protection programs, the number of practices that have been installed, and then the total phosphorus and sediment reductions that we've achieved through those grants. Again, we do the same thing on the drainage grants. We track the number of practices that have been installed, and we can track the amount of phosphorus and nitrogen and sediment that have been reduced due to these practices being installed. The next category of programs under the Clean Water Fund are conservation easement programs, and we have two of them, the first one being the riparian buffers. And these is where we acquire permanent conservation easements along lakes, rivers, streams, and tributaries ranging from 50 feet to 100 feet with the Clean Water Fund. We also use outdoor heritage funds to purchase buffer beyond that 100 feet to get wildlife habitat benefit in addition to the clean water benefit we get with these dollars. The wellhead protection easements are easements that we acquire that protect land that the Minnesota Department of Health has designated as having high or very high vulnerability to the drinking water, and so we're able to secure permanent conservation easements and prevent activities that might threaten that drinking water in those areas. Here's what we're working on so far with the last biennium of funding under the riparian buffers. We have funded 142 easements. Again, 46 of those have also used outdoor heritage funds to supplement that buffer beyond the 100 feet. I also just wanted to note, again, along the theme of outcomes and what is this money doing on the ground, Bowser has participated in some work that was partially funded by the Environment and Natural Resources Trust Fund to look at what are the effects on the water quality of these buffer programs and land retirement. And so this was a study that looked at three small watersheds within the Minnesota River Basin and specifically looked at the biology in these streams as well as the chemistry in these streams. And the good news is that in terms of the chemistry, we are seeing decreases in phosphorus and nitrogen in these streams that have the highest percentage of land retirement. We're also seeing an increase in the biological integrity of these streams in those watersheds that have high land retirement. So we feel that this is a good strategy to continue to achieve the state's clean water goals. Then the third and last category of funding through the Clean Water are enhancement programs. Again, these are really about Bowser's oversight of the money that's going out the door to the local units of government, all the tracking we do, and the results that we do measure. So that's the first category. The second category, or let me just walk through the first one here, the conservation tracking. We have an online system we call eLink. This is where all of the grant applications are loaded, as well as all the reporting along the way. And we are in the middle of an update to the system that is about to be launched this April, and it will be vastly upgraded, much easier for the local units of government to enter their information and easier for us to track. And it'll really be from application to grant closeout, a complete system that tracks where the money is going, what it's funding, and what results we're seeing on the ground. Then the second piece of this category is funding of these restoration evaluations that are statutorily mandated for the Clean Water Fund, the Outdoor Heritage Fund, and the Parks and Trails Fund. We do this work in partnership with the Department of Natural Resources. And the first evaluations recently were completed with the first report being submitted to the legislature at the end of last year. And so how this works basically is to take a sampling of the clean water and habitat restoration projects that are done and to look at the effectiveness of those restorations on the ground from this team of experts. And this first report generally found that the projects are meeting their intended goals. They did make some recommendations for the future on how to make those project goals and information more consistent, and then also stressed the importance for long-term monitoring so we can really track the outcomes over time, because it's very hard to see the results of these restorations in just a year or two. I think one of the things that we really would like to stress with our clean water funds is that the demand for dollars and the need to have projects on the ground far exceeds the money that we receive for these types of projects. And so in this chart, you can see the four colors represent the various grant programs, and you can see that the amount requested versus the amount awarded. The amount requested is quite a bit higher. We can only fund somewhere in the neighborhood of half to sometimes even less than that of the dollars that are requested from us for these projects. Just very briefly, Mr. Chairman, I just wanted to mention that the Board of Water and Soil Resources has five projects that have been recommended for outdoor heritage funding by the Lessard-Sams Outdoor Heritage Council. They're all various easement programs under our RIM program. Four of them are continuing phases from projects that have been funded in the past. The one listed at the top, the Grasslands for the Future, is a new program really intended to be a pilot for us to see how RIM might work for grassland conservation, working lands, and to work with some nonprofit partners to better understand what tools are needed to address the grassland crisis we have and the high number of acres of expiring CRP. And then lastly, we have two programs that have been recommended for funding by the LCCMR from the Environment and Natural Resources Trust Fund. These are both continuations of past projects, the first one being technical assistance to local governments. This is really funding to have people on the ground going out and talking to landowners one-on-one who may want to sign up for RIM or Farm Bill programs to do what we can do to address this problem of the high number of expiring CRP acres. And then the second program is a continuation of a Conservation Apprentice Academy, which we run in partnership with the Minnesota Conservation Corps. And it's a great program that takes young people and puts them in a soil and water conservation district office so they can get some real world experience, and we can help train the next generation of conservation professionals. Mr. Chairman, we'd just like to end here with a summary slide that just once again shows the total summary of all the funds, the general fund, clean water fund, the other state funds, our federal funds. This information is also shown on your handout on the back page in a little bit more detail.
Ms. Stroman, regarding the Lassard SAMs or the clean water or even the LCCCMR, where does aquatic invasive species fit in? Cleaning up the water and restoring water to what it was. Have we done anything there? I know there's something in LCCMR regarding funding for research at the University of Minnesota, but is there anything else that has been funded in that area?
Mr. Chairman, our agency does not have funding for invasive species through those programs. The Department of Natural Resources may have some other programs.
All right. Any questions for either one of the witnesses? Senator Osmond.
Mr. Chair, and to the testifiers, I have a question about water resources themselves. Does Bowser have a position on people taking water from their lakes and using for sprinkling lawns, using for internal purposes? Is that, I know this might be a little specific and you might not have an answer to this, but do you have, I'd be interested in knowing any information you have on that. Are you aware of any position that you guys might have on that type of subject?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Osmick, we can get you something on that. I know that certainly the Department of Natural Resources is the ones that regulate water supply and use, and so if you're pulling water out of a lake, you know, above, I think the number is 10,000 gallons per day, you have to get a DNR permit for that. So I think what I would ask, if you don't mind, is to go back and get some information from them and pass it on to you after the fact.
Mr. Chair, and thank you very much. I would appreciate it. The reason I bring this up is once every 5 years, the Minnehaha Creek Watershed District goes off on one of their tangents and starts making new rules. And their latest rule that I've now become aware of and I'm getting pushback on from my local jurisdictions is that there's new regulations from the watershed on how much water residential people can pull to do any kind of activity on their shores. So I'd appreciate any of that feedback. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions? Okay, thank you very much. Who's got people from farther away here? Huh? You got people from farther away than Senator Skoy does? Senator Ma? Huh? Are these quick? Okay. Senator Bachman, go ahead if you're in a hurry. We're trying to get the people from farthest away up first.
Mr. Chairman, is 4.5 hours further than Senator Skoy's?
Well, Mr. Chair, I think these guys are here for the co-op meeting tomorrow, so they're probably not heading home tonight. But
actually, International Falls is probably closer to 5. You have to be pushing it pretty hard to make it in 4.5.
Definitely.
Are you guys sticking around until tomorrow?
Huh? I've been here since Thursday.
The roads aren't that bad.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chairman, I think that Irv Anderson could make it in 4.5 hours.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Westrom.
I'll be shameless, Mr. Majority Leader. I hope I can get you on my speed limit increase bill. We can get that done.
Be happy.
Tom did? Did we get stopped last night?
Again, yeah.
I don't want to know what happened.
In your district.
In my district.
Mr. Chair, doesn't it seem ironic that the person proposing a speed limit increase is the guy who can't drive?
I think it's totally appropriate.
We're here?
That was one of my...
Senator Scoy.
You know, he can't drive, but he makes a great basketball ref.
One of my favorite movie scenes is Al Pacino in Scent of a Woman, where he takes that Ferrari for a ride. Mr. Chairman,
that was a blind guy, just so you know. That was driving, and he did a heck of a job.
I think it was Al Pacino, wasn't it? Yeah.
Senator Bach, Senator Westrom just said he's seen the movie.
Wait, every time I bump into him in the elevator, he says, "Nice to see you." So Mr. Chairman,
which one are we doing?
Senate File 201.
Okay.
Is a bonding bill for a wastewater treatment extension up in St. Louis and Coochichin County. There are, and you'll see there's a handout that show the number of failing systems up there on Lake Capitogama and Crane Lake and Rainy Lake. A lot of rock, soil, all on water, a lot of failing systems, drain seeping sewage into the lakes that make up Voyageurs National Park. We badly need to put a pipe in to collect this and move it to a municipal system. So the bonding bill, the request is actually for $8.575 million. It has to be matched with non-state sources of the same amount. All of the accesses that exist up there are all private. The capacity of those small businesses that service the park, there just is not enough capacity there for the small number of people that live and have resorts there to be able to build on-site systems that will take the traffic that a national park brings you. So with that, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Pavlik, one of my county commissioners from Coochichin County is here. He's the chair of the sanitary district up there, and he can explain this much better than I can.
Say your name for the record.
Okay, my name is Commissioner Wade Pavlik, Coochichin County.
Welcome. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. As Senator Black pointed out, I'm the chairman of the Joint Powers Group that's overseeing this. We're in partnership with St. Louis County. 20 years ago, I would have been down here in front of Senator Lessard's committee arguing with the park and how things have changed over 20 years. I now find myself working with them and my county board. A lot of things have changed over those years. Some of my constituents say I went to the dark side, but the reason we are here today is because...
No, I have to give you the money.
We're here about clean water. It's that simple. And without it, none of the promises that were made to us when Representative Anderson and others here at the state legislature worked so hard to form that park along with the national government. A lot of those promises have never come true. We are now facing an environmental impact and, quite frankly, an economic one. And I'm going to have one of my constituents speak to that here in a minute. We view it as a partnership between the state, the federal government, and, yeah, local government. And I can tell you that locally in Coochichin County, I'm going to use that for an example because that's where I've been a board member for so many years. In this particular project, we've already put in $400,000 county dollars in trying to move this forward. And that we've got a small county, 13,000 people. We view it as a value to the entire county, but we need the partnership, and we need the financial help from all three sources, local, state, and federal. What you have before you today is that request. You know, as I just want to tell you that we've been here in the past, and we have used that money to get it done. We've got Rainy Lake halfway done. This is a joint powers agreement that includes, and if you could take a look at your map, you can see the four areas spread throughout the entire park. This is a park-wide project to keep it clean, and you've seen some of the failure numbers Senator Black referred to. I mean, they're alarming. I'm going to tell you that new state rules, when it comes to making a mound system, for an example, as another way to do this other than central sewer, it does not work up there. We're on the Canadian Shield. It's bare rock, I don't care what kind of system you put in, it's going into the lake. There is no way around it. So we have no other solution than managed systems. Centralized sewer is one of those. At Cap Totem, we're looking at a bit different there, where we're going to have a collection system. Still managed, you have to have the pipes. Ash River, we've got a lot of work to do there. And Crane Lake, where they have a treatment system, and we've got a lot of sewer in there already, too. So we're well on our way, but if we're going to get this completed and make it viable, we're going to need help. And that's my request before you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Commissioner. Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Commissioner, for that report. And I'm just wondering, you quoted how much the county has put in. How much has the feds, you've been dealing with them for some time, I'm sure. Is that where the other matching money is going to come from here?
Commissioner.
Chairman, members, I can only refer to the last project we did in Coochaching County when we went halfway up Rainy Lake. We're probably three quarters, actually, now. Federal government was a large player, probably between one-third and one-half the entire project. The state helped out with the rest, and my constituents are paying approximately $4.5 million over 20 years for their share through a monthly assessment, correct. So it was really a joint effort. We got that money, if I could, Mr. Chair. At that juncture, we received it through the WARDA funding at the federal level.
Any other questions? You have a constituent here?
Chairman, Mr. Doherty is here from Rainy Lake Households. And we'd like to have him say something as a private business owner with a concern about the lake.
Just say your name for the record.
Thomas Doherty.
Go ahead, Mr. Doherty.
I'm the co-owner of Rainy Lake Houseboats on the east end of Rainy, or the west end of Rainy Lake there. And I'm also the vice chairman on the Island View Sewer Committee, and I also participate in the Joint Powers meetings as well when we meet monthly in Cook, Minnesota. But just a little bit about, I'd like to back up in time with in history a little bit here with our family's history in tourism. My great-grandfather bought the Kettle Falls Hotel in 1918, and I spent a lot of time there as a youngster up until 1978. But there was a very special day up there when I was young. I was about 9 years old. It was Voyageurs National Park Day. And they flew in and boated dignitaries and state representatives from all over the country to officially dedicate the national park. I can remember John Blatnick and Congressman Obistar, who was an aide at the time, planting trees.
You're dating yourself here.
Yes, I am. But I was paying attention. And they were giving speeches and making proclamations as to what Voyageurs, their vision of it would be, that we were going to see an increase in visitation. We would see different infrastructure being put in, roads, visitor centers, and things of that nature. And a lot of time has passed since that time. And I can honestly say that the number of resorts that we had at that time has diminished. In fact, it reads somewhat like an obituary. A lot of resorts, you know, that were within the park boundaries closed, even resorts that were along the perimeter of the park closed, basically all due to costs that they saw a rise in property tax costs and also operating costs related to putting in on-site sewage treatment systems that basically didn't work. You'd put a system in and you'd fight with it for a number of years and throw the towel in on that one, and the state would tell you you'd had to put a mound in and you'd try and work with that. So it's been a struggle, and we've seen these numbers of resorts and accommodations available to visitors in the area diminish. You know, and our visitor focus has also shifted over time. Back when the park was first formed, you know, a person was basically happy with just a simple cabin and an outhouse, perhaps. But in today's world, we all know that's changed. People want different amenities. They want finer accommodations. They want swimming pools and meeting facilities and all of the things that go along with that. The way we're sitting right now, we can't even look to do any of that because we don't have the ability to treat the wastewater. I'd like to talk about just a little bit about one resort in particular, Shea Shea Resort. Maybe some of you folks have heard of Shea Shea. It's at the end of the road. It overlooks Voyageurs National Park. It sits on a rock outcropping. They have a number of cabins for rent, and they also have a large restaurant and bar facility. The new owners have been there. This will be their fifth season. They employ up to about 40 people. People always complain to us that, you know, as a houseboat operator, they're looking for places to go, and they'll come back and say, why do we have to eat with plastic silverware? Why do we have to use plates? or paper plates and things like that. And I have to explain to them, you know, the 95% of the wastewater that Shea Shea generates, they have to truck it to International Falls to have it treated. It costs them nearly $30,000 annually to do that. There again, they're held back on their ability to expand and improve their facility because they can't afford to generate any more wastewater at this point. Also, Thunderbird Lodge, which is the only lodge that's actually open 365 days a year, that's right across the bay from our facility. They were faced with closure this winter due to lack of snow cover initially, and it froze up some pipes that were leading to their mound system and burnt out a couple of the large pumps that pump the effluent out there. It's just a constant struggle. As far as looking down the road, providing that the sewer system does come in, there's some, you know, bright spots from the economic side once the we do have an adequate way to treat the effluent. There's a girls' camp up there called Camp Gitche, which is affiliated with Camp Kuchiching. It's relatively new. They were able to buy one of the resorts that, you know, unfortunately threw the towel in because they couldn't afford to exist anymore with the issues related to wastewater treatment. They're looking at a large expansion. Right now they can accommodate up to 110 girls in what they call two sessions throughout the summer. They're looking at doubling that up to 220. And with that brings their families, when they drop them off and when they pick them up, they enter our area, usually spend a week on each end of the girls' month-long visit at the camp. When we've looked at the, Commissioner Pavlik mentioned the Jackfish Bay project, and that's just a short ways from us where it ended. And in that area, we've seen some bright spots there where once the pipe was put in, the residents there were able to build some new homes, remodel, make some other changes there, and improve their living situations. So we've seen some, you know, some positive economic impact from that. And I guess, you know, the best example that we could see from an economic standpoint would have to be at Crane Lake, where they've been at it for a few years there and had the pipe extended to a few of the different areas. But Voyageur Lodge is in the process of completing a $2 million new lodge that they're building there, and that'll add an additional 2 to 3 employees to their facility. And I guess in concluding, I'd just like to say it's been 40 years since the park was formed, and it's not just about cleaning up the water here. We also, it's about jobs and maintaining our current level of visitation and also giving us the opportunity to move forward with some improvements and expand accommodations and activities for future people.
Thank you, Mr. Thordy. Any questions of either one of the witnesses? Senator Westrom.
Mr. Chair, maybe one of them, have you applied for funding through PFA? And what I'm wondering is that if you have, do you not make the criteria list high enough to qualify for those funds because of sparse population? Or have you had any interaction with that with that agency?
Sure.
Chair, members, thank you for the question. Yes, we have applied for PFA funding. The problem we run into on these types of projects is that they're lineal. They run with the lake. PFA bases it on what's within a circumference of a circle. We cannot meet those requirements because our projects go in length following the shorelines of the lake instead of a circle. So that really hurt us for the points on PFA. It just didn't become viable. We've run into the same problem on other projects, both in Crane Lake, St. Louis County, and Cooch. PFA becomes, that's something we'd like to see change because it stops improvement of the water quality because of that particular rule. And just it works fine everywhere else. It doesn't work well on a lake system or a river system where everything's aligned.
Mr. Chair and Commissioner, I ask because Senator Ingerbritzen and myself have had a similar experience where some new systems were going in and ultimately it got shut down because the expense on the individual property owners was so great that it was going to be as much or more valuable than the property in some cases, but they had the same trouble, so that's why I asked the question. So thanks.
Is this in Pucks Point sub-district of because this little flyer here says that you're in the process of securing $1.5 million in grants and loans from the Public Facility Authority for Bucks Point Subdistrict. So there must be somebody coming in, I guess. Is that part of
it? Yeah, that's accurate. Now, Plex Point, we're looking at a different type of situation, a different system. It's going to be a drip irrigation system. We've just reached a tentative agreement with the DNR to acquire the only property that was suitable for it, and then everything will be piped there. So yeah, that became more a circumference issue instead of a lineal one, and we were able to get some funding on that. So we're in the process of moving that one forward.
So is that the next bill, or is that this bill?
Another one.
It's another bill. Okay. All right. Senator Ingebrigts.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, just a little idea. I mean, we did work with the lake system Senator Westrom talks about, and we know what the costs were when the PFA didn't have any money. I mean, we just some years ago, there just was no funding available at the beginning of the recession, so they backed out of the project. Without the $8.5 million, what would it cost each owner? What's it going to save, maybe I should say, each owner of property on that system? Can you give us an idea?
For sure.
Be quite some significant, I would think.
Chair, or if I could, Chair, Mr. Chair, members, it would be significant. In fact, it would make the project undoable. And we do have experience at this. We, you know, since we've been through these projects before, we've got a lot of experience over there on Crane Lake already. What we found is that when you exceed, you know, the 125 to 150 a month range for the individual homeowner in terms of fees or assessments, the support drops off. And we, you know, when we did the project on Rainy Lake here, and I was involved in that from the beginning to end, we started out at $80 a month, and when it went to 100, I mean, I've been sued and threatened, and the county board, et cetera. Well, the thing, just to show you how things have changed, once we got that project in and the cost did go up, it's over $100 a month to them now. People realize, yeah, even my strongest opponents have come up to me and said, Wade, you did the right thing. The people in the rest of this project area have seen that. The issues of not wanting it aren't there anymore. It's when can we get it? Because these people are sitting there with essentially substandard systems. Here's the problem. MPCA, when it comes to mound systems, which is the only feasible solution up on that rock, they are requiring redundant systems. These take up a lot of area, which make most of these lots substandard. And mound systems do not work there anyway. We've got all kinds of experience with it. So we're left with no choice. It's this type of system or none. But I can tell you the construction improvements are so great. There's no more of this digging up the rock and blasting everything to smithereens in that rock area. What we do is directional. The process now is directional drilling. Grinder pumps, a small 2-inch pipe goes through the rock and right to the treatment system.
Just really quick follow-up. So the treated water is eventually going to go back into the lake system then?
No, it's going to go to a treatment system at International Falls. The one at Crane Lake goes to their treatment system.
Okay.
The one at Captogamo will go to a drip irrigation system, which is a managed system by the MPCA so that there are none of those issues.
Okay. All right. No further questions, and we'll lay Senate Files 201 over for possible inclusion and recommendation to the bonding committee. Is 351 quick?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. 351 is probably pretty quick.
Okay, go ahead.
Thank you, Chair members.
Mr. Chairman, we just finished up on the west end of Voyageurs National Park. If you look at your map, you'll see there's another area over on the very east end, the pink piece on the map that says Crane Lake. That's one of the other entrances, not only to Voyageurs National Park, but to the Boundary Waters Canoe Area. And there, what we have is the Crane Lake. We're looking at pushing that pipe out to get out to the boat landing, pick up a lot of additional properties into the municipal system. The DNR has a significant boat landing there with an outhouse right now, and it is actually the only public restroom facilities for 30 miles, and 30-mile drive, if you can imagine. So what we're proposing is some money that on the site of the boat landing, we build a restroom facility at that boat launch. And that's a very, very busy boat launch at Crane Lake because it accesses both Boisers Park and the Boundary Waters. I have a constituent here, Mr. Rob Scott, who can speak to it in more detail than I can.
Mr. Scott, just say your name for the record, please.
Mr. Chair, my name is Robert Scott.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, if I may, my background at Crane Lake has been essentially my whole life. I was drafted in 71, retired in 03. Other than that, I just basically have lived and been a business owner in that area the whole life. The Crane Lake Sewer District was conceptually put together in the mid-90s, when operational in 2004. I'm the chairman of the sewer board. We were able to secure different funds as well as take out loans to get a system installed that included a treatment plant. Since then, we've been able to do one expansion. The Hamburg Road expansion, as it's named, is our second expansion effort. The problem with the expansion effort and the reason that I'm here today to discuss the need for the additional funding for the restroom facility is that due to our current $1.4 million debt service that we're under, any funds that we can receive to preclude us from going into any type of loan situation, you know, is paramount to be able to get the project, you know, going. Essentially, we are right now in the planning stages, funding stages, and the system is such that with the existing force mains and the existing treatment plant, we essentially are shovel ready to be able to utilize, you know, the funds when they become available to start the expansion effort.
Mr. Meyer, something to say or no? Are you
Mr.
sitting there?
Chairman, or, no? Members, just for the record, the DNR does support this bill.
All right. Any questions then? Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And from Mr. Meyer, this obviously has been done before but with the graces of the DNR on other areas. I mean, can you give us a little history for those that don't know as far as restrooms on these particular areas? Is there some studies that have to be done or no?
Mr. Chairman, members, this particular project would come into play once the pipe and the second phase that the testifier was just talking about is completed. But as you heard on the previous bill, maintaining the water quality on these lakes is a huge priority for us. So participating in these types of projects is in the best interest of everyone.
And I don't know if you know this, Senator Bach, is the previous bill shovel ready also? And would they be ready to go, or would they have to procure some other funds? Or is this a... I should have asked that earlier. We can find that out.
Mr. Pavlik tells me the earlier one is ready to go.
Okay. Any further questions on this one, then? If not, then we'll lay Senate File 351 over for possible inclusion in the recommendation of the bonding committee. Thank you, Albert. Wait, what? This is a budget bill, so this doesn't go to bond. So wait, do we have to vote on this then? Possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Okay. Senator Scoy.
I can start.
Which one do you want to do first, Mr. Senator Scoy?
Mr. Chair, let's do 117. These folks from Park Rapids, they've got a bit of a drive in front of them yet this afternoon. Actually, they had a number of members that weren't able to make it to the cities, including our handouts weren't able to make it down. So we've got an executive summary for you that I'm handing out. But, Mr. Chair and members, what I'd like to start by is just a brief introduction of the area of the Upper Mississippi area. Includes Lake Itasca State Park, much of the heart of the lakes country, going over toward Detroit Lakes and down to Walker. And in the center of this area is the city of Park Rapids, and in Park Rapids is the armory that was used for many, many years as our men and women were preparing to go off and serve this country. As I toured the building with the members of this arts organization earlier this winter, it is a great building. It's got these curved steel trusses supporting the roof, just a big open area where there would be great to have a performing arts area. And then down on the lower level, there's a number of rooms where there would be a possibility for some permanent exhibits or a number of art exhibits. And I'll tell you, as you walk through the building, you can almost hear the sounds of the history. The building is located almost, it's on Highway 71, one block from the junction of 34 and 71. Very, very high visibility location. I think that members, if we're able to get this accomplished, it would be a tremendous asset for the Upper Mississippi region. And so with that, I think I'll turn it over to, I don't know who's going to go first, Mr. Dave Collins. He's a Hubbard County Economic Development Director, and then there will be a couple other testifiers also.
Okay, thank you, Senator. Go ahead, Mr. Collins. Just say your name for the record. And
David Collins, Executive Director, Hubbard County Regional Economic Development Commission. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, it's an honor to appear today for this project. We're really excited about the Upper Mississippi Center for the Arts in our region. We've had a longstanding arts organizations that kind of fight above their weight. We kind of become a center for a lot of people retiring. Our population's growing. So the arts, we've got a strong art center, display art. We've got art sales. We've got a performing arts group called the Northern Lights Opera Company, which does a number of projects throughout the year. They've been looking for space for quite a while that they could call their home and expand their offerings and become a complete arts program where they're offering classes to kids, outreach in the community, the whole works. At the same time, we've had the Armory Building, which has been vacant for 20 years, and we have a gentleman here that likes to solve puzzles. And he looked at this armory as a puzzle, a part of our downtown. There's four areas that have been abandoned basically by government over the last 20, 30 years. There's what's partially a senior center now. It used to be an old fire hall. It's right next to the armory. The armory was abandoned. Across the street, a Carnegie Library was abandoned. And then across the street the other way is an old high school that was abandoned. So it's kind of a blighted area in our downtown, and we've made a lot of progress in our downtown in the last 6-7 years. We hired RDG Planning to Design to find our downtown and decided what we wanted to become. And so after spending a long time studying that, getting the plan together, we've spent almost $60 million implementing and renovating our downtown. Originally in the plan, this armory building was identified as something that we needed to address. And with Alan's unique talent and vision, and I really mean it, you'd have to tour the building to see how uniquely he has been able to shape that building. And the annex is a women's clothing store and a Mexican restaurant. But anyway, now we're trying to marry those two together, put those two entities into one unit.
Mr. Collins, I want to point out to the committee that marrying the arts and the history are not constitutional or illegal questions.
Right, so okay. All right. Thank you. So anyway, we've had a ton of organizations involved, and this is just some of those organizations. There's over 16 different organizations that we're bringing together under one roof. And we started the downtown project again by defining our area, defining our market. The population increase in our area over the last 10 years was 13.2%, and our retail sales from 2006 to 2011, since we started this project, have increased 90%. Now, a Walmart is a part of that, but we've also got a new central regional grocery store and a number of other things that have impacted that. The community identity and doing economic development, I've studied a lot over the years, read a number of books, and in a rural area, we've got to take control of our destiny into the future. And so we've done that with our downtown study, with our armory study, and what we're proposing with this project to renovate and continue to renovate our downtown. Part of the art program is we have a collection of masters worth several $100,000. This is a picture from one of the productions that was done recently in the Park Rapids area. This is what we define as our regional market area, and we fill from a good strong base for our resorts and different things. If you look at this map, the stars kind of show concentrations based on state sales tax reported that are arts related. This is us right here. This is Bemidji, and this is Detroit Lakes area. But this whole area has a whole, if you look at the entire northwest Minnesota, is kind of a regional arts-related area. Right now, for some of the stuff that we're doing in Park Rapids, we're drawing consistently from Bemidji and the Detroit Lakes and that regional area. It is a rural area. People live out in the cabins, resorts, and so on. As we got into this project, we got an ARBA grant, Rural Business Enterprise Grant, through USDA for $104,000. We did a feasibility study of this concept and the building itself and how we could finance the building, do the building. And part of the result of that was it's estimated the potential economic impact is $3.125 million a year. These are some of the organizations and so on that are involved. And right now invested in the project, we have a number of organizations, the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, CERTS, the Office of Energy Security, Industries for Park Rapids, the Northwest Minnesota Foundation, the Headwaters Regional Development Finance, Midwest Minnesota Community Development Corporation, and some HUD money through them, private enterprise, cities revolving loan fund, county support, and then, of course, the ARBEG USDA grant. So we've made considerable progress already on this building. About $2.2 million has been invested in it, getting it from smelling like rats and everything else and really filthy and dirty to a clean building, which I'm going to have Alan describe the details of it and what he's done with that. And my notes are a little disorganized. We had about five of us making the presentation, so we quickly reshuffled some of these. So I'm shifting papers back and forth. The number of events that were hosted.
If you hadn't told us that, we wouldn't have known.
Okay, that's my mistake. We're already hosting a number of events downtown and in the facility already. And I'm going to turn this over to Alan real quick, but I think I have covered most of my notes, and we're going to keep this really short for you. Yes. Okay, we've also, the Upper Mississippi Center for the Arts has also got two gentlemen and a solid organization that have stepped forward and volunteered to do a private fundraising drive. So we're still defining the exact amount of that, and this is going to impact that a little bit. They're fully expect to raise over $1 million in money. We get strong local and city and county support. While we have not asked them for a formal vote for the Upper Mississippi Center for the Arts and the financing, they have gone on record a number of times in support of Alan's efforts to bring the building to the point that it is now. We've got one of our councilmen here with us today. We've got a few more people behind the screen here you can't see. And we lost one of our councilmen who's kind of emceed this today in the process. So we're excited. And with that, I'm going to turn to Alan Zimick. And Alan is grew up down here in the city, spent his summers growing up in Park Rapids, fell in love with the area. He actually lives in Southern California, spends about 40% of his time in the Park Rapids area, commutes back and forth. He's almost got a Norman Rockwell love for the community and a dream and envision of what this could be. And so he's put a lot of time and energy trying to solve the puzzles and put pieces together. Alan.
You're putting a lot of pressure on him.
Yeah, no pressure. For the record, my name is Alan Zemek, and we're shovel ready.
You haven't been in Southern California recently, it doesn't look like.
I left, it was 75 degrees, and I was picking oranges off my neighbor's tree, and without fail, for the last 10 years, I've managed to make it just in time for the coldest week of the year.
We've been colder this year. This is just going to be snow.
This is just snow now. Yeah. Again, my name is Alan Zemek. I really appreciate this opportunity, Chairman of the Senators, to present to you a project that our community has been working on for 5 years. We initially got involved in this project through David Collins and our local city council. Some of the people that are not here today because of the weather are the president of our Downtown Business Association, Park Rapids Lakes Area Chamber of Commerce, the president of the Park Rapids Lakes Area Arts Council, which is a consortium of 16 different arts organizations, the Northern Light Opera Company, the Namath Arts Center, the Classic Chorale, the Heartland Concert Association, the Jack Pine Writers Block. It just goes on and on. The project became interesting to me. I'm a real estate attorney. with an affliction for lost causes. The National Guard pulled out in 92 as part of a consolidation of 11 units, and they walked away and gave the keys to the city of Park Rapid and said good luck. It is one of the most prominent and historical facades in downtown, and through its history was always the place where the community gathered for social events and cultural events and artistic performances, everything from craft shows to weddings to cigar smokers, the auto show in 1936, the snowmobile show, everything happened there. When that left, it tore a big hole out of the economic fabric of our downtown. The prospect of a Walmart store coming to town was, quite frankly, a little bit frightening. And we have worked very hard and diligently to find a strategy to basically survive and thrive. It's a very proud and self-reliant community. In many ways, I was sitting here listening to what you heard this morning about quality of environment and quality of water and clean water. And we're 20 miles south of the crown jewel of the Minnesota State Park System. And we can't make it just on clean water and trails. The season's too short. People's needs have changed. You've heard earlier this morning of how the what people are used to seeing and getting now is much more sophisticated. And my dad put me in a station wagon with six kids, two dogs, and a canoe on the roof, and all the stuff they could cram into the third row seat. And we drove up to Park Rapids, and the rule was no phone, no TV, find a book or entertain yourself, and the rest is history. My kids come up and they're like, there's no Wi-Fi.
Spoil them.
Spoil them rotten. But as our economy has changed over the years, the Park Rapids area is a regional hub now for a much more diverse economy that has become, we're very proud of our history of logging and agriculture. We are where the eastern hardwoods forest, the Great Plains, and the boreal forests of the north all intersect. It is really a fascinating and interesting geography and ecology, and water quality is very much a part of our experience. But what attracts people to that environment of lakes and trails and water is the cultural life that we also provide. None of these organizations we have to exist. They kind of grew up spontaneously on their own. All of them recognize they've hit a plateau with the resources that are available in the community, and if we're going to continue to thrive, we have to find an intersection for arts and commerce to work together. My background is business and real estate transactions that are supposed to meet a hurdle rate. There's an investment return on this I think is quite tangible. It's real. We did a proof of concept performance last fall. We went around downtown and asked, and some of our restaurants said it was like Saturday night in July. And this was the late September at the end of the season. So the economic benefits of this project are quite tangible and quite real. We think it's a very appropriate investment for the state of Minnesota to make. And with that, I think I should maybe stop talking because I'll just go on forever.
Thank you. Senator Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just have a question regarding, first of all, I would like to say that I think it's important that we repurpose historical buildings in small towns all over Minnesota and anywhere we can, because I think that's the history of an area gives us a flavor and gives our kids something to think about it. But I was just wondering if you had gotten any money from the arts part of the legacy money, or if you've applied for any of that.
Our legacy money comes to our arts organizations through the programming side. Northern Light Opera Company, Namath Arts Center, all of them do get grants through programming. What we're asking for is an ability to provide the capital investment to allow that programming to continue and flourish. We're somewhat limited. We have an auditorium at the high school. The high school has a different mission, and so we're only able to access it at sometimes rather inconvenient times, and we can't really take those arts programs to where we think they should be and where we think the demand is, not only just from Park Rapids. People from the Guthrie and the Walker and the Minneapolis Institute of Arts, we've had curators from those institutions come look at this facility, and they've all said, you have something here that can be really quite special. So we are reaching out all across the state into any reservoir of talent we can find.
We did look at legacy funds a little bit, trying to find funds for capital expenditures, and weren't successful.
Mr. Collins, just a curiosity. Is the funding – the funding's not to – is it to buy the armory, or is it just to renovate? And who's going to be the owner? Is it going to be privately owned or publicly owned?
The facility would be owned by the Upper Mississippi Center for the Arts and either the Park Rapids or Hubbard County Economic Development Authority. And we're looking at Allen has developed the building to this point, but the facility would be purchased from him and controlled by the nonprofit and the EDA.
Okay. If I, I'm sorry.
Go ahead, Senator.
Mr. Chair, the money is to be used to renovate the building, not to buy the building.
Right. Okay, all
right. Right, this money would be used to renovate.
Okay, Mr. Zeman.
Right now the building is owned by a private corporation. We just recently completed...
The building's owned by a private corporation, is that what you said?
Yes, it was set up specifically for the purpose of dealing with the private... It's a private-public partnership. Every public dollar that's put in, there's been a private dollar put in. And we're financed by, initially, the Department of Employment and Economic Development for brownfield cleanup activities, Midwest Minnesota Community Development Corporation, Northwest Minnesota Foundation, the Minnesota Historical Society have all participated in it. The building, my role in it was to enter into a redevelopment contract with the city of Park Rapids to accomplish the remediation and rehabilitation and remediation of the site. This building had lead paint, asbestos, PCBs, fuel oil contamination, everything any private sector investor would run away from screaming. This building had all of those liabilities. So my obligation to the city of Park Rapids has now been 100% fulfilled. We have completed all of our obligations to MMCDC in terms of employment and job creation. As a private commercial venture, we have taken this as far as it can evolve. But the highest and best use of the property really is to become a center of gravity for the community and replace really what was lost when the guard left.
Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And we are working to make sure that the ownership is in accordance with the capital investment of state dollars.
Okay. All right. Senator Rood.
Mr. Chair, so am I understanding this correctly that the arts legacy funding is only to be used for programs and not real estate buildings, that type of thing?
Yes.
Is that correct? And that's why this would not qualify for any legacy funding for the building portion of it?
I think that's a work in progress, but I think historically you've categorized it right. I mean, I don't think there's any rules against us doing it some way else, but so far we haven't been doing it that way.
Okay.
And I think we'd probably have a hard time building anything with legacy money because everybody would be asking for construction money from legacy money and but it's a good question, okay?
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So any other questions from the committee? Any other comments? You don't have any other testifiers, right, because they didn't make it?
Well, Mr. Chair, I think we'll keep it brief today. There are other people here, but I think we've gone through the presentation pretty well and hopefully answered the committee's questions.
But did somebody come here that came to testify on this?
Say something?
We've got one.
Yeah.
And we do have copies of the RDG study. Feasibility study that was completed. I got hard copies, and I have copies.
As long as you waited all this time, you might as well say something.
Yeah, for the record, my name is Ryan Zemek. I'm the Economic Development Director for Headwaters RDC, which is the five-county north central area.
Related to the other guy?
Small-town northern Minnesota, you know what's going to happen. Right. Yes, that's Alan's my uncle.
Okay.
And I, you know, just to speak to the regional impact of this, our commission, which is made up of 22 elected officials, private sector representatives from post-secondary education has selected this as one of nine what we considered vital projects for redevelopment, for economic growth in the region. And it mentioned earlier by David, I mean, it's something that draws from Detroit Lakes, Bemidji, Walker area, east, you know, and then south down to Wadena. So it's really a regional impact that we've projected.
Okay. Senator Scoy.
Thank you, and hope for positive consideration, Mr.
Okay,
Chairman.
Okay, so we'll lay this over for possible inclusion to the in the recommendation to the bonding committee. Thank you all very much. Senator Scoy's got Senate File 333 now.
Why don't you step back for a second?
Go ahead, Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members. And members, I'm here with Senate File number 333, which is a bill dealing with the DNR fees that are charged as they are dealing with utilities that are crossing public lands. This bill specifically deals with utility crossings when they're using a current road right-of-way. This issue's been around for a number of years. I can't remember if it was 2007 or 2008 when this original fee increase took place, going from $500 to a proposed, I think it was $5,000 at that time. I carried a bill at that time to reduce the fee, and I started at what I thought was a pretty reasonable number and compromised from there. So I've redrafted that original bill to be a little more a little better starting point for the negotiations of no cost. But members, I want you to draw your attention to the fiscal note that I believe is in your packet. There's a fiscal impact for this bill, according to the department, is $700,000. And so what's happening is we have this public land that is a state asset, and for the benefit of all Minnesotans, and when the DNR is managing that land, they're passing the cost of that management on to just the people who live there and the utilities that service those people through these utility fees. It just seems completely unreasonable. Most fees are supposed to bear a relationship to the cost associated with delivering the service. And for these utility fees, when they're going down a road right away, there really is very little work for the DNR to be involved in. Evidently, they have to record some of these easements. But I think from the testimony that I've heard earlier, most of the work is being done by county employees. So I'd like to have a ongoing or a continuing discussion with the department about these fees that they're charging utilities as they're crossing public lands, particularly with regard to the road right-of-ways, which I read the fiscal note are 75 or so percent of the water crossings originate on a road right-of-way, and I think it's 80% of the land crossings or vice versa. There is more fees associated with utilities crossing public lands that are not dealt with in Senate File number 333. Every time a utility has to cross a snowmobile or a bike trail, they have to pay a fee to the DNR for that crossing. And there's also the issue of the renewal fees. So we've probably generating $1 million total in revenue for the DNR to manage public lands for the state of Minnesota and its residents that the utility customers are paying. And it just doesn't seem reasonable to me. And so I brought this bill forward. Eagerly listen to the testimony today and listen to what the department has to say. But I think that as we move forward this session, we should be considering whether these management costs shouldn't be borne by the state as opposed to the people who happen to reside in the area where this public land is located. And so with that, I'd like to turn it over to a testifier from Lake of the Woods.
Yeah.
Say your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, Dan Hoskins, general manager of North Star Electric Cooperative, located in Baudette, Minnesota. And
you have a constituent here, Senator Scalzi. Originally from Baudette.
Oh, is that?
You're really far away.
Yes, we are, Mr. Chair.
No, I think he could have gone first, Senator Scoy.
Well, but Mr. Chair, the interesting thing of these co-op folks is they have their meeting down here, so they're not going home tonight.
So their timing was good. Okay. All right. Go ahead, Mr. Hoskins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The timing was good, especially with the white stuff that we're expecting, but we don't mind staying a couple more days. North Star Electric, if I may, is an electric cooperative. It's located up in the Boundary Waters, up on Lake of the Woods, all the way along Rainy River, Rainy Lake. We serve approximately 6,000 member owners in the western portion of Roseau County, a lot of Lake of the Woods County, a lot of Couchiching County, and the northwest corner of St. Louis County. And the portion of that, our service territory, which is served, we have 1,400 miles of line that encompasses most of this property. We have 4.5 members per mile, and in that area, there's approximately 60% to 70% estate land. So wherever we get a new member or a proposed new member, there's a lot of permits or applications that we have to go through because we cross a lot of land. We have hundreds of permit crossings. Up until 2009, we had no really issues with the permit filing or whatever. It was $500 per permit. As members signed on, we just passed that cost on to them. In 2009, however, and that $500, I may add, was for water or land crossing. In 2009, a supplemental application went through, and the fee for water crossing for an application was $1,500, and the fee for land crossing was $4,500. In 2010, supplemental fees were reduced, and I believe by Senator Scoy's bill, was crossed to land crossings were dropped to $3,500, but the water crossings were increased to $1,750. And these are application fees, non-refundable. So if you are rejected, or if you have a change of, the proposed member has a change of heart and does not want to, you do not get that money back. That's a non-refundable cost. And
Paid by the applicant?
I'm sorry?
Paid by the applicant?
Paid by the cooperative, we billed the applicant. Yes, Mr. Chair.
Okay, all right.
And these crossings, and then they, once they're, if they are approved, that's not the end of it. There's also a lease or access fee, which is added to each crossing. Now, we have no idea what these fees are at the time. It depends on the amount of stumpage in this 40-acre plot has to be removed for our right-of-way. It depends on if it's a water crossing, river or creek, or a bike path, or a roadway. A lot of it depends on that. So we don't know what those fees are totally. We know what the application fee is. We don't know what the total of the fee is. Now, I would say, you know, we do have, right now we have in front of the DNR, we have a application that has 113 renewal applications on it. We are renewing 113 40-acre plot application crossing permits. The DNR did work with us on this one. I will give them that credit. They let us put all 113 of them on one application. The problem is we don't know what the bottom line charges with these 113. I would like to see the renewal applications, because these applications have been paid for once, these permits. I think they should be until that line is removed and for utilization for those people. You know, I have to say that the best thing that ever happened outside of my religion is in May 12th, 1935, when President Roosevelt signed the REA bill, and we were able to bring power to the rural areas. That was the greatest thing. And this neighbor would sign an easement for this neighbor, and this neighbor would sign an easement for this neighbor, and these two would sign an easement for all these, and then all these would sign it because we could serve this city, and we still get those easements today, and nobody charges, but we have 70% state land. They're the only members that we have that charge us for their easements or permits. So I would suggest that the fees, I would like to say one more thing. $3,500 fee, if that's a duplication fee, when I go out, my people go out, we stake the line, we line it up with a transit so it's straight. We measure it from the nearest boundaries. If it goes across a bridge, it's the nearest bridge abutment. If it goes across a road, it's measured. You know, it's measured from the nearest mile marker. It's also put on a map, and all of this mapping. And when we fill out an application, the mapping has to be sent in with the application, the legal description. All that has to be done. So if it's a duplication fee, I would think that we should be able to work with the DNR and do that. But so I also brought a couple other people with me. I brought a couple of board of directors, Mike Truman and Julian Brosnowski. I also brought from our office our assistant general manager, Ann Ellis. I also have behind me with the Minnesota Rural Electric Association, Joel Johnson, to help me and assist me with this testimony and to answer any questions. And Joel, if you will, okay, so I guess at this time, that's where I'm at, and that concludes my, again, thank you for this opportunity to talk about this bill.
Senator Scoy, do you have somebody else you want?
Yeah, I don't know if they want to ask questions or Mr. Hoskins now or not, but I know Mr. Collins is here, and is Mr. Lynch here? Mm-hmm. They would like to testify also.
Do both of you want to testify? Go ahead.
Mr. St. Clair. Well, I'll be very brief. David Collins, Executive Director, Hubbard County Regional Economic Development Commission. RDC, REDC, a number of years ago, when I got hired, one of the things that we identified that was really important for our economic growth in Hubbard County was broadband infrastructure. We've been through a lot of ups and downs trying to get fiber to every home and every cabin within Hubbard County. And recently we helped one of the local telephone co-ops get a $17 million rural utility service loan, only to have the FCC come back a month later and announce that they were going to eliminate intercarrier access fees over the next 9.5 years. What that did is that's going to eliminate a major source of income for telephone companies in the state of Minnesota, Paul Bunyan, Arvig, and so on. Paul Bunyan was estimated to lose $3 to $4 million in annual revenue. So going out borrowing $17 million to put in fiber when they lose that revenue stream is very, very difficult. So the $17 million would have built out the rest of Hubbard County, and some of it was going to go to the Grand Rapids area, about $2 to $3 million. So instead of building out the entire Hubbard County like we thought we had done, they're now kind of, well, I call it cherry-picking. They're surveying territories, trying to determine if there's enough density to justify putting in the investment. This summer, in one of the areas that they identified, and we're looking at the second area, they had three customers that wanted to get service. The permit to the DNR would have cost them $3,500 a base fee, but by the time the formula figured in, the footage and the inches that they were going to cross would have been $8,500 fee to the DNR for them to provide service to three customers. So at that point, we called Senator Scoy, and always very, very helpful. And we put together a meeting with Itasca Mantrap Electric Co-op, Arvig, Paul Bunyan Co-op, our county Public Works, and so on, and had a long discussion, and that's why we're here today. So with that, I'd like to introduce Pat Lynch with Arvig for a very brief, and then Rob St. Clair with Paul Bunyan Communications.
Thank you. Mr. Lynch, just say your name for the record, please.
Patrick Lynch.
And you are with?
I'm with Arvig Communications.
Okay, go ahead.
We operate several thousand miles of fiber optic and copper and cable television systems throughout the state. With the growth of demand for a high-speed connectivity between sites outstate and to the rest of the world, we found many customers are looking for connectivity, often fiber optically based. So it's new construction for us, laterals off of existing and new backbone facilities. And as these cross the DNR facilities, the incremental cost that the fees add to the project often impede or eliminate the viability of the project for our customer to proceed.
Is it possible, Senator Scoy, that one goes across and then back again and you got to pay $1,000?
Well, Mr. Chair, I really don't know, but I know that if they're going along and they cross 140 and then they have a series of private ownership and then another series of state land, I think there's two crossing fees there.
Okay,
and as I mentioned, even if you're crossing a snowmobile or a bike trail, they're getting into these crossing fees even on those. Well, you know what the snowmobile trail system's like up in this area.
Yep. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Lynch. Go ahead and say your name for the record. And then
I'm Rob St. Clair, Network Operations Manager at Paul Bunyan Communications in Bemidji, Minnesota.
Okay. Thank you. Go ahead.
I guess I just kind of want to echo what the other people that testified. It is true, you know, when you mentioned bike paths and snowmobile trails. We have quite a few customers down in the LaPorte, Minnesota area that are actually on the other side of the bike path, while the highway's on, you know, one side of the bike path, customers are on the other side. You know, every crossing potentially is $3,500 to go underneath or over the bike path. So you take, like Mr. Collins was talking about, we're in the process of overbuilding some of the rural parts of Hubbard County. We have potentially 3-4 customers in the Emmaville area that are on the opposite end of a bunch of DNR property. Well, for us to try to build those customers, you need to tack on an extra $8,000-$9,000 permit fee on top of an existing $10,000-$20,000 build to get to those 3-4 customers. You know, it really does make it detrimental to the project. You know, and with, you know, the task force is out there trying to provide, you know, or we want to get broadband to as many customers as possible in the rural parts of the country, you know, fees like this just really make it detrimental to the project.
Okay. Mr. Mueller, do you want to give a little explanation of the fiscal note that we have in front of us?
Sure, Mr. Chair. As Senator Scoy mentioned, the effect of this bill would be a loss of about just over $700,000 of fee revenue that are tied to these crossings. And let's look on the first page where it breaks out those fees by fund, and it looks different things are happening between the funds. The first one, the general fund, the $127,000, that's a straight-up loss of revenue to the general fund, sort of like a tax expenditure if you want to look at it that way, where it doesn't affect the DNR's expenditures at all. The next two, the Natural Resources Fund and the Miscellaneous Special Revenue Fund, these revenues come in and then are statutorily appropriated back to the DNR. So those two lines would result in a direct reduction of DNR expenditures because they wouldn't have the revenue coming into the account and wouldn't be able to spend it. And then the last one, the permanent school fund, that one also is just a straight-up loss of revenue to the permanent school fund, which the interest then in that fund goes out to schools. But that the fees lost on the last one wouldn't result in expenditure loss to the DNR. So I just wanted, depending on where the fee goes, it may or may not result in a loss of expenditures to the DNR. So it would be about, you know, a little over $400,000 lost expenditures to the DNR out of that $700,000 of revenue.
Just a question, Mr. Mueller. Are these fees charged every single year, or are they one-time fees?
Depends. Mr. Chairman, it depends on the fees. Sometimes, and maybe the DNR can go over this more. If you look on the second page of
this is indicating that they're going to happen every single year and that we're going to get exactly the same amount every year.
Well, Mr. Chair, I don't know that that's the case. I think that there's renewal for existing licenses, mm-hmm. but these are mostly for new crossing fees.
Right, and how do we know that this is going to happen every? I mean, this has got to project it out into 17 that we're going to have the same new applicants, same amount of new applicants every single year. And how do we know that's going to be the case? I know you can't answer that, but anyway, hey, go ahead, say your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Kathy Lewis, Assistant Director, Lands and Minerals, DNR. There's basically three fees that we're looking at here. One of the ones is to keep in mind is these are 50-year licenses. There's a one-time fee paid at the time the license is issued. So, for example, on the public water crossing, Senator Saxog brought a bill a few years ago that said the revenue for the market value for using the public waters for 50 years goes to the corpus of the permanent school fund. If it's a land crossing, you're often crossing school trust lands with their fiduciary responsibilities. There's university trust lands. There's acquired lands. So there's a market value fee that's paid one time up front for the use of the land or the water for 50 years. There's also two types of application fees. There's a general fund application fee of $500 that existed, and the general fund used to fund the DNR to do the work. That general fund appropriation to the DNR was discontinued by the legislature in 2009. They kept the $500 general fund fee. Doesn't come to the DNR. Goes to the general fund. It has nothing to do with our license program.
Did the governor recommend that discontinuation of the money to the general fund?
Mr. Chair, members, there was an issue brought up. The DNR asked if we could have that $500 as part of the fee, and the answer was no, that was going to continue to the general fund. There is a supplemental application fee, which is the money that pays the DNR to do the work, and so that's the $400,000 you saw there, and that pays for our staffing to do all the work that we do for review of the applications. They can have multiple crossings in an application. As for example, you heard the one in Coochin County has 103 crossings. That's crossing 103 different pieces of DNR-administered land for the crossing. It's one application fee. We're reviewing the land ownerships. We're doing a resource review. We have to do federal aid review. We're monitoring the construction of the line. We're looking at invasive species issues, protecting nesting habitats.
Who does the monitoring? Who does all this monitoring you're talking about?
Mr. Chair, members, the DNR lands and mineral staff will go out and monitor the construction of the lines.
And are these people on salary?
Mr. Chair, members, the money that comes in the application fee pays for their costs for doing the work. If we don't have the application fee, we won't have the staff to do the work.
Are these people on salary?
Mr. Chair, members, yes, they are on salary.
So what are you telling me here, that they won't get paid? They won't get paid if these fees aren't?
Well, Mr. Chair, members, if we don't have a supplemental application fee, we won't have the money to pay their salaries, and so we won't be able to issue the licenses because the supplemental application fee is the money the DNR has in order to pay the staff to do the work.
So your employees are totally dependent on application fees? What if there's no new applications? Are these people all going to be fired from the DNR?
Mr. Chair, members, the application fee is our source of funding for several of our staff to do the work. If we don't have application fees, we could not pay the staff, and they'd have to be laid off. That's correct.
Senator Scoy.
Mr. Chair, first of all, I think the 113 in one application was for a renewal. That would be crossings that already had occurred and they were renewing them. I think I heard the Lake of the Woods testifier talk about the renewals that were all bundled into one. I'm not sure if it was all brand new crossings that were bundled into one. That didn't seem right. But the one point I'd like to make, members, these things are going down existing road right-of-ways. This is not going off across natural forest or swamp or prairie. The road is there. Primarily, they're going down the back side of the ditch. And a ditch is a ditch. It's not anything other than that. And I from my discussions of what happened in 2009, and thank somebody for reminding me what year that was, it was actually happened in 08, they had a budget problem again in the state, and they were short money at the DNR, and this kind of just became a way to fill a hole in the DNR's budget. And it just seems unreasonable to me to have that occurring on, you know, while the utility pays it, the customers pay for these things in the end. I mean, if you're an electric co-op, that's all they have is their customers to pay for it. They don't have any other abilities. And so I just think that we should be looking at it. You know, maybe the $500 application fee should go to the DNR, but this supplemental application fee was just put in place to because they had a hole in one of the lines in the DNR budget back in 2008.
Senator Weber.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think Senator Scoy maybe answered one of my questions. I was thinking about the application where there was 130-some crossings in there, and I was going to ask, well, does that mean that that application is paying the same fee as an individual would if they were having a crossing at that point in time? Which, you know, obviously the work for the 133 is greatly magnified as opposed to a single crossing. But if it was a renewal, I understand there's some differences there. The other thing is I wanted to make clear in my mind, because the 2009 date was previously mentioned, so what exactly were the fees that would have been incurred for an application prior to 2009? Is it simply the $500?
Senator Scoy.
Get somebody who knows.
Ms. Lewis.
Mr. Chair, members, prior to 2009, there was a $500 application fee plus the market value fees for the 50-year use of the property. So they had two fees. What was happening at that point in time is that when we did an assessment, we said it's costing us more than $500 to do the processing of a license. The general fund appropriation to the Lands and Minerals Division of the DNR was supplementing the cost for issuing a license. And so the decision was made in 2009 that instead of the general fund supplementing the cost, in effect, the user pays. And so that was the decision by the legislature to remove the general fund appropriation from the DNR to do the work and to increase the cost to the person applying for the license.
Senator Weber. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just so I understand, and then besides the $500, the second part of that, that money went where at that point?
Ms. Lewis.
Mr. Chair, members, for water crossing licenses, the fee used to go, the market value fee used to go to the suspense account of the permit school fund, and the forestry division could do cost certification against that. Senator Saxhog brought a bill about that same period of time that changed that, so on the water crossings, the revenue goes directly to the corpus and no cost can be certified against it. For land crossing, it depends on the land classification type. So for school trust lands, it goes to the suspense account for schools. For university trust lands, it goes to the suspense account for schools. And then for game and fish land, it goes to the game and fish fund. And then for acquired land types, some go to the general fund, and there's one or two exceptions like parks and trails. So it depends on the land classification type.
Senator Scoy? Senator Scalzi has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And if you look on page 3, when they're talking about long-term fiscal considerations, we're looking at either the general fund bearing the cost with an appropriation that we would give, or the state could authorize the activity without acquiring a license, or the state refusing to grant utility license. So for the number 2, if we authorize the activity without requiring a license, what's the long-term problem with that happening? And maybe the DNR could speak to that.
Ms. Lewis.
Mr. Chair, members, if you have that situation, you're going to have a loss of revenue for you're going to be allowing the use of state land without receiving any revenue for it. You have potential loss of federal funding. If the land has had federal aid attached to it, it would be a violation of federal aid restrictions to allow an encumbrance on the land without federal approval. And the federal aid restriction that exists, they could take away more than just the federal aid for that parcel. They could have penalties assessed against the state. You have potential loss of natural resources. You have no control of clearing with chemicals. You have potential destruction of nesting habitat. You have potential spread of invasive species. There's no requirements to plant native seeds to restore the property. You don't have flight diverters being required, and there's no protection for habitat and erosion protection. So those are some of the steps we're taking with our licenses. There's also a safety issue because you wouldn't have oversight on placement of poles next to trails and road crossings, and you would not have maintenance and administration when they do maintenance or road or abandonment on properties.
I know. Did you guys do the fiscal note, or did somebody else do it? Because I'm just curious why the fiscal note assumes that the same amount is going to be collected every single year.
Mr. Chair, yes, the DNR did the fiscal note. What we did was we did an average for a few years, and we said on average we're getting 235 utility licenses a year. Actually, in fiscal year 12, we're up to 273 for fiscal year 12. We assumed an average, said it's a regular pattern, instead of trying to predict the economy and saying if it's up or down, we're just, for our fiscal note, we assumed an average for a number of years.
Any other questions from the committee? Mr. Meyer, you don't have anything to add, or do you?
Mr. Chairman, just briefly, as the testifier spoke of, this didn't become an issue until 2009. It was in preparing that budget. The department took a hard look at where general fund was subsidizing commercial activity, and we prepared a budget proposal that was submitted to the legislature to put in place some fees to support that general fund activity. This was one of the suite of fees that the legislature passed into law to help us continue those activities that were supporting the general fund. We have several like provisions within the budget bill this time that we've talked about within the committee, but it's a decision the legislature needs to make. How much should the general fund be supporting these types of commercial activities where they can be passed through or other people are paying those costs? And what level of services should the state be providing when people want to use these parts of the state lands? Enbridge Pipeline, for example, ran through most of probably Senator Scoy's, Senator Saxog's, several other people's districts, and
they didn't go down the road, Mr. Chair. But they didn't go down the road right away, though.
But they did pay these utility crossing fees, and there are huge impacts from those types of utilities going across school trust land, for example, that the school trust should be benefiting for. So it's a decision that the legislature needs to decide and provide direction to the department what we should be doing and how to fund those if these fees should not be in place.
Why does the DNR not keep computerized records of when utility crossings are within an existing right-of-way or public road?
Mr. Chair, members, that's a piece of data that all the data we're collecting, it's not one of them. We did an estimate based upon the four regions that work with them. So they did their analysis based on their experience, but it's not a computerized piece of data that we maintain.
And why not? Seems pretty easy to put this in the computer if you're going to be giving me a license or collect a fee for it.
Mr. Chair, we're working on a new land record system, and I'll take that back to the staff to discuss.
There you go, Senator Scoy. It's going to be free after you get it in the computer. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, I asked exactly the same question in 2010 when I carried this first attempt to change the fees on this land. And at the time, I mean, it seems like such a easy, relatively modest cost to go around with the GPS units that they already have. I mean, we know they're using GPS to do property boundaries and to record these points and keep them on the map, but
well, we have a,
it hasn't been moving
we have
forward.
An amendment for your bill then when we get around to it, okay?
Well, Mr. Chair, I don't know what your wishes are with this bill. If it comes up before, if I have the opportunity to bring it before the committee, I am going to draft an amendment just to eliminate the supplemental application fees. And looking at the 70% of the water crossings and 85% of the land crossings are within the width of the public road right-of-way, and we have to deal with aquatic invasives and special plants and plantings anyway, I think we should just eliminate 100% of them and not worry about them just being on a road right-of-way, because the vast majority of them are in the road right-of-way anyway. But that would be a couple of potential amendments if we have an opportunity to consider this in the future, Mr. Chair.
Senator Dietzick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would also like to know
because in this fiscal note it says the bill could cause the state to lose significant federal aid, and so do you have any more, and I don't need it now because you kind of talked about it generally, but just any more specific examples of significant federal aid that we would lose if we did this?
Do we know that now, Ms. Lewis or Mr. Meyer? Or
Mr. Chair, members, I don't have those kind of numbers for you. I know we've had instances in the past that we have brought letters to legislative committees threatening to the federal government for significant reductions of the federal aid, but I cannot give you anything today.
Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Dietze. This is a concern that every agency in the state brings to the legislative committees. If you're making a change to their funding, they say, well, you're going to threaten our federal dollars. I'm not asking them to not do the work. I'm asking them to go back to the funding mechanism that they had prior to 2009.
Okay. Any other questions or comments? Okay. Seeing that, Senator Scoy, we'll lay this over for possible inclusion in the
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
And thank you all for coming, and thank you for all the testimony. Okay. What do we got on Wednesday?
Do we know yet?
Okay. We'll be doing bills again on Wednesday, then, members.
Regarding the renewable energy standard to go to.
Oh, and then there's a joint meeting of the subcommittee on legacy also at 3 p.m. in room 123. So that's for Wednesday. All right, with that, meeting adjourned.